This is Liz Siegert, one of the co-producers of HealthCetera. I'm speaking today with Amy Florian. She's a thanatologist. What's that? Let's find out. Thanks for joining us today, Amy.
You're most welcome, Liz.
So, thanatologist, that's an unusual term that many people may not be familiar with. Can you explain what it is and how you got into this interesting career path?
Certainly. Thanatology is a subset of psychology. Thanatos is the Greek word for death. And thanatology is the study of death, loss, grief, and transition. So that's my field. I got into this field, I backed into it, really. I was widowed when I was 25 and our son was 7 months old. I had no intent at that time to make a career out of thanatology. I was just concerned with survival, with getting through, with how was I going to cope with this. And I had very few resources to help me because I was in a little town in rural Iowa. There was no such thing as a support group or many of the resources that are available today. One of the ways that I coped was by writing in a journal. About 5 years after John died, I went to a seminar on grief and loss, and the presenter was saying some things that I didn't agree with. So I let him read some parts of my journal, and he said, "Oh my gosh, Amy, you've got to get some of this published. And by the way, would you start giving seminars with me on grief and loss? I need your voice." That's how it started. Once one group heard me, another group wanted me, and another group wanted me, they started asking me my credentials. I didn't have any except my own experience. So I went back to graduate school. I have a master's degree. And I'm a fellow in thanatology, which is the highest level of certification you can get in that field. So in the last 30 years, I have facilitated support groups. I've worked with over 2,000 sick, dying, and grieving people. I've taught undergraduate classes. I taught graduate classes for almost 10 years. And I travel all over the country teaching people how to cope with grief and loss and aging and transition. And it's one of the most meaningful careers that I could ever imagine.
It's an amazing story. Do people experience the grief process similarly? We've heard about the stages of grief, but do people kind of go through them almost in a pattern?
Actually, no. There are similarities in the grief process. There are things that we basically can look for and anticipate are going to happen, but it's really a unique experience for each person. Which of those things they experience or how they experience it is unique for each person. The talk about the stages of grief, that was developed by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in 1969. And it was actually her study of people who were dying to find out what kinds of emotional processes they go through when they find out they're dying. It's not really even the stages of grief. And she confirmed that before she died a few years ago. It's more like the stages of getting bad news.
Mm.
Even if you experience all of those things, the five stages, by the way, just to be clear, are denial, anger, bargaining, depression or despair, and acceptance. Now we do tend to, she did great work. We do tend to experience these things when we get bad news or catastrophic news. If you find out you're dying, that's quite bad. We do tend to experience these things, but we don't experience them in order. We don't experience every one of them. Some people never get angry. Some people don't bargain. Some people don't get depressed. Even if they experience every single one of them, it's not like it's a linear progression where first you're in denial, when you're done being in denial, then you're angry, when you're done being, it doesn't go that way. Grief is a roller coaster. People bounce up and down and back and forth. They feel like they're taking three steps forward and two steps back, sometimes two steps forward and three steps back. Even after they reach, for instance, the stage of acceptance, then something happens and they go back to, I just can't believe this. This didn't really happen to me. It's all over the place. In the field now, we really don't even use those stages. We use other formulations of grief, behaviors people exhibit or tasks they need to do in order to heal, rather than the stages of grief, because it's very difficult to apply.
So what are some of these tasks that people can start doing? Because we've all run into the situation where people will think, well, they should be over it by now, or it's time they got back to reality.
Well, that's a myth too. The myth is that there is a point of final closure. The reality is that if this is a significant death, you live with it for the rest of your life. You never forget. You don't want to forget. Why would you want to forget somebody you love? My husband died over 30 years ago, but I am a different person because he loved me. Nobody can ever take that away. I will remember him for the rest of my life. You see, when we heal from grief, we do heal, but we never totally close the door. When we heal from grief, it means that we have let go of what can no longer be. We've let go of their physical presence, of the ability to hear their laugh, their voice, the ability to bounce ideas off of them, or to read something in the newspaper and say, oh, I just got to tell my mom. We have to let go of what can no longer be. But we never put it behind us and get on with life. We create memories. We create memories out of the life, the love, the lessons, who we are because they were in our life, and we carry that with us. We carry it with us for the rest of our life. We never forget. And because you never forget, for the rest of your life, you will occasionally get ambushed. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it'll be things you don't expect. You walk into the store and that song is playing on the PA. And it might be that you've heard that song 50 times and it didn't do anything, but that day, depending on what day it is, how tired you were, what else had happened, it just grabs your heart and you're sobbing in the aisle. Other times it's things you do expect. Like my little 7-month-old baby boy, he grew up. Mm-hmm. He's 6'4". And when he walked down the aisle to marry the woman he loved and his daddy wasn't there, do you think I didn't cry? It had been 28 years. But do you think I didn't cry? You see, we never reach a point where we will never miss them anymore. We'll never wonder what life would have been like if they were still alive. We'll never cry. You don't do that. So to expect people to put it behind you and get on with life or get over it, those are myths. You don't do that. You accommodate your life to it. You assimilate the loss into your life. You learn from it. You assimilate it into who you are. And you use that to go forward and build something that doesn't exist yet, to go into a future without what can no longer be, but enriched by the memories. You become a different person. You hopefully become a better person. And you move into the future enriched by everything that has happened in the past.
That's a great way of thinking about it. As you say, most people would not want to forget their loved one. And sometimes the situation is reversed. And I'm going to bring up the recent deaths of Carrie Fisher and Debbie mm-hmm. Reynolds, because many people are conjecturing, we don't know for sure yet, that Debbie Reynolds might have died from a broken heart because the mother and daughter were so close. Is that even possible?
Absolutely. We have in 1990, that was the first time that this syndrome was described, but we call it now, we call it broken heart syndrome. It's got other technical names like stress-induced cardiomyopathy or apical ballooning syndrome or Tatsubo cardiomyopathy. These are different technical names for it, but commonly we just call it broken heart syndrome. It mimics a heart attack. And it does actually have physical symptoms in the heart, but unlike a heart attack, which is caused largely by blockages in the arteries, there are no blockages. There's no prior physiological deformities or anything that would indicate this is going to happen. Yet when it happens, the heart sort of balloons out. It gets misshapen. The heart rhythms are thrown off. There's shortness of breath, wide changes in blood pressure, a lot of chest pain. And we treat it actually with some of the same drugs that we use in treating heart attacks, like ACE inhibitors and beta blockers and diuretics. It is, in general, eventually harmless. Most people spontaneously recover from it on their own within a few days or a few weeks or certainly a few months, because there are no blockages in the heart. The blood vessels are completely normal, mm-hmm. even though there are areas of the heart that are dilated and ballooned out and very weak. The exception to that, which is what may have happened with Debbie Reynolds, is if the heart is already weakened, this can put it over the top. It can cause fluid to build up in the lungs. It can lead to an actual heart attack. Or sometimes those irregular heart rhythms that are caused by broken heart syndrome can lead to clots that then break off and cause a stroke. 7% of patients who have broken heart syndrome end up actually having a heart attack, a stroke, or another major event within a month. It can be fatal, especially with someone who doesn't have the will to go on. Most often when, for instance, a spouse is widowed after 60 years or 70 years of marriage and they don't want to live without the deceased one, they lose their will to live, their will to fight, then the heart is affected this way and they die.
Is it psychological as well as physical, or is it really a physical reaction to the sudden loss or maybe even not so sudden loss?
I'm not sure you can separate the two. Statistically, there are so many connections between our psychological and emotional psyche and our physical health. We know, for instance, that grief affects the immune system. The immune system is compromised when people are deeply grieving. People can't think, can't concentrate. The brain gets flooded with cortisol. Cognition and rational thinking abilities are pushed down to the level of survival, and they temporarily lose some of those upper level thinking skills. Grief can cause headaches and throat tightness and muscle aches, back aches, shoulder aches, overall weakness, exhaustion. Grief is exhausting. There's so many physical symptoms that result from psychological trauma. And this is true across the board, not just for grief, but across the board. There's so many connections between psychological trauma and physical trauma. It's very common for people who have heart attacks and they survive and perhaps have heart surgery. They struggle with depression very commonly. Mm-hmm. Now, why would having a heart surgery cause depression? We don't really understand, but we know it does. There's a strong link, in fact, between mental health issues and heart health. People with depression and anxiety disorders are at a far greater risk of having heart attacks, heart disease, and broken heart syndrome. Older adults are more susceptible to the physical effects, especially if they are already frail, if they're weak, if they're in ill health, if they've had a weak heart, or if they have struggled with especially depression, mental issues or neurological issues like seizure disorders or epilepsy, things like that. People like that are much more susceptible to broken heart syndrome. A study published in the Journal of Nursing Research found out that risks of death in older people are much increased by being widowed after a long marriage, by chronic disease, and by lack of physical function. So all of these things work together or perhaps debilitate together. Mm-hmm. Sometimes for these long-term spouses too, sometimes the surviving spouse has been a caregiver for years and the spouse dies and they're just exhausted. Mm-hmm. They stop taking care of themselves. Maybe they skip their medications. They don't eat. They become depressed. They may die of all kinds of preventable causes just because they don't see the point in living anymore. They mm-hmm. don't know who they are anymore. I mean, they've been Mrs. So-and-so for 65 years, their entire adult life. Now, who are they? And their married friends don't know what to do with them because they're single. They don't know why they're getting up in the morning. I got up in the morning in order to take care of him. He's not here. I don't even know why I'm getting up in the morning. I don't know what the purpose of my life is. I don't want to go on without him. And the psychological effect can definitely have an impact on the physical. There, you've probably read about all these different cases. I mean, Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash died within months of each other in 2003. In 2014, Florine and Ed Hale died with 36 hours apart. They were moved into the same hospital room so they could hold hands in their final hours. They've been married 60 years, and they died 36 hours apart. Another couple that had been married for 45 years, Tom and Naomi Shirley, died 10 minutes apart from each other. And these things, they're the exception to the rule. Most couples don't die within close proximity to each other, but when they do, it always makes news because it's so interesting, and it does resonate with our experience.
If you're dealing with a family member or even a work colleague who has experienced some kind of major loss of a spouse, loss of a parent, what can the average person do to help them through this grief?
No matter what, when there's been a significant death or loss, they need support. The problem is that we're never taught how to do it. So what we do is pick up what everybody else does and perpetuate the mistakes. They need to tell their story much more than they need to be told how they should feel. What we tend to do when there's a death is we go in to fix it. We go in to cheer them up. We go in to make it better. We go in to give them hope. That doesn't work. What they need is to be companioned, not to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a much, much more difficult thing to do because you have to be willing to listen. You have to be willing to sit with the pain instead of, oh, there, dear, cheer up. It'll be okay. Really, it will. Here, have a tissue. Dry your tears.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of that, to go in and say, this is really tough, isn't it? I got a good shoulder. You want to use mine? What's this like for you? What was it like to hear those words? Who are the most supportive people for you right now? What is something that somebody said that you just wanted to slap them? Boy, you'll get stories about that.
I'm sure.
What are the hardest times of the day for you? Instead of asking, how are you, for instance, how are you is a lousy question. First of all, it's impossible to answer. Well, what do you mean? When I woke up this morning, I felt lighter than I had any time since the funeral. But at 10 o'clock, that song came on and I just lost it. But then I had lunch with friends and I felt a little better. But oh my gosh, then the afternoon dragged on forever. Grief is such a roller coaster. It's impossible to just answer, how are you? And what people really want to say is, well, how do you think I am? My child just died.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. You know, we tend to be very compassionate with people that we know are trying to do the right thing, but they're just not. So normally what we do is answer, fine, thanks. Thanks for asking, I'm fine. It's not the truth, but it gets them by. Saying, I'm so sorry. Really? Not half as sorry as I am. Saying I'm so sorry lets people know you care, because that's our standard way of letting people know that you care. But it doesn't really accomplish anything. In fact, it cuts off conversation. I don't even have a good response. You tell me, I'm so sorry. What am I supposed to say? Thank you? And then what do we say?
Right.
If I do say thank you, what do we say? Instead, just to say, I'm here for you. This is tough. What is it like for you? I want to help. I could run some errands for you, or I could take you to coffee, or I could clean your house. What would be most helpful for you? Instead of what can I do? Because people can't think. Give some options of things that you would be willing to do. Give them a choice. Be willing to sit with them. Be willing to ask good questions and just listen and listen and listen. Be willing to let them cry. Don't be too quick to hand the tissues to them. Let them cry. Be there with them. Walk them through it. Don't go away. Notice those important days, like his birthday or her birthday, the wedding anniversary, some of the monthly anniversaries of the death, certainly the yearly anniversaries of the death. On those days, what is everybody else doing? They're ignoring. Mm-hmm. We don't know what to say, so we don't say anything. We make excuses. Oh, I'm sure she wants to be alone on a day like today. Really? Oh, I don't want to remind her what day it is. As if.
Right.
We make excuses to protect ourselves because we don't know what to do. So call them up. I know what today is. It's Jim's birthday. So what do you have planned? Are you planning to go to the cemetery? Are you just going to cocoon at home? Are you getting together with people? What is today like for you? And then listen. Be there with them. Make contact. Support them. Those are the kinds of things that we need to be doing that people aren't taught, but they make all the difference in the world.
Do you find there are gender differences? Men try to be very stoic and not perhaps show their emotion outwardly or cry. Is it harder for men in some ways?
Well, in general, older generations have a harder time expressing their grief outwardly because they grew up with so much of the big boys don't cry, big girls don't cry kind of thing, denying of grief. Our society denies grief. And so we all have a hard time expressing our grief outwardly, at least in public. Too much of our grief happens behind closed doors in isolation. And it would be easier and we'd heal faster if it didn't have to happen that way. The other thing about gender, though, people assume that men grieve differently than women. And actually, that's not exactly true. Several years ago, two prominent thanatologists, Ken Doka and Terry Martin, set out to discover how men grieve differently from women and found out that actually there's two major styles of grieving. Mm-hmm. More men tend toward the style we call instrumental grievers, which are people who experience grief more in their head than their heart. They focus on little things, facts and statistics, and they want to take action. Their question is, what can I do to get through my grief? If they're going to talk to somebody about their grief, they're more likely to talk one-on-one than to go to a support group or something like that. More women tend toward what we call the intuitive style of grieving. They experience grief more in their heart than in their head. They focus on the big picture and the emotions, and they want to gather people around and talk. Their question is, who can I talk to get through my grief? They're more likely to go to a support group than individual grief coach or counselor. Now, that being said, and that is consonant with our experience for the most part, but that being said, it's like any personality characteristic, we're all on a continuum somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You will very rarely find somebody who is 100% instrumental or 100% intuitive. I'm actually halfway between. I have some instrumental tendencies, some intuitive tendencies. And maybe that's why I can facilitate support groups. I don't know. But what we need to do is kind of figure out where you are. Do you tend to the instrumental side or the intuitive side? And then allow the other person to be wherever they are, because it's all normal. Everybody grieves in their own way. Nobody is supposed to grieve exactly the way that I would. They grieve in their own way. Some people want to take action. Some people want to talk. Some people want to cocoon. Everybody needs support.
Mm-hmm.
But to figure out the best way to support them, it's helpful to understand a little bit more about their grieving style. And don't assume it based on gender. Because it's a personality characteristic and we're all on a bell curve, I've met really instrumental women and I've met really intuitive men. Just goes across the board. You can't assume based on their gender how they're going to grieve.
What kind of work are you doing now?
Largely what I'm doing right now is working with firms and organizations, philanthropic organizations, financial advisory firms, estate planning attorneys, healthcare, anyone who has clients or patients or people they work with who they have long-term relationships with. Anytime they're walking people through a long part of their life, they need to know what to do and how to handle it. I've taught nurses. I've taught hospital chaplains. I've done a lot of work in churches because
mm-hmm.
that's where people go when there's a tragedy, when there's a divorce, when there's a death. They go to their churches, their synagogues. They go there to get counseling, comfort, and to have the rituals that we participate in when there's been a death. So I've done a lot of work with churches as well.
It's a very interesting and obviously much needed occupation. How come there don't seem to be more people like you out there.
It's growing. I wish there were more people like me out there. I find that I face a lot of obstacles. When I want to come in and teach people, for instance, how do you help the people that you love when they're grieving? It's sometimes difficult to get folks to come because they think it's going to be depressing. It's not depressing. It's life-giving. When people, if you could walk into the services after a death and be absolutely confident that you're not going to be on the conveyor belt like everybody else, saying all the same things and having the grieving person never even remember that you came, but you could walk into those services and really make a difference. You could offer comfort. You could do something that most people don't know how to do. Then you'd go. Right now, people tend to avoid services because it's uncomfortable and it's awkward and we don't want to look at death or mortality or anything of the sort. If somebody is terminally ill, people don't go visit them because they don't know what to say and they don't want to face mortality. And then they're looking at death in the face, and we're just so death denial that we have a hard time going there. I think that also is a factor in why there aren't more people like me. Because you're going to make a career out of this? I've had people tell me, oh my gosh, how depressing. I can't believe anybody would do that. But as I said, it's life-giving. I get to see the twinkle come back in the eye. I get to see the cloud lift and the shoulders come back. And to help people heal, to really make that kind of a difference in people's families, in their lives, in their businesses too, but I'm aware that even when I'm teaching business people, I'm not just teaching business people. I'm teaching people who have families and friends. And sometimes that's where the impact is the greatest, is with their own family, their own friends, that they're better equipped to help the people they care about, the people they really love, in addition to their coworkers or their employees or their clients or customers.
Where can people go to find out some more information about Thanatology and grief counseling?
There are many books out there by really excellent thanatologists. In terms of my own books, I have a book called No Longer Awkward, Communicating with Clients Through the Toughest Times of Life. It's on Amazon. And it gives a lot of information about all different types of life transition, including divorce and dementia and death. It gives texts you can write in condolence cards. It gives books that you can recommend to people, just a wide range of information. It was written for a professional audience, but I'm finding that more and more people who are not in a professional situation are using it. And because of that, within the next couple of months, my next book will be out. It's going to be called A Friend Indeed, Help Those You Love When They Grieve. And it's going to be the same type of information, but focused more on death and grief, that type of loss, and focused on the non-professional person. So those are books that I have out or coming out. There are also some wonderful other books that are out there. There's so many of them. Well, you can look at the chapter in my book. But Rabbi Earl Grolman, Helen Fitzgerald, Therese Rando, William Warden, Alan Wolfelt, a lot of wonderful people who are out there doing good work in teaching people more about grief and how to help each other.
Awesome. Amy Florian, thanks so much for being with us today on HealthCetera. Again, Amy is a fellow in thanatology. Am I pronouncing that right?
That's correct, yes.
Which is the study of death and dying. Slightly unusual field, perhaps, but obviously one that you bring a lot of knowledge and compassion to. We'll look forward to your new book when it comes out.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.